Not that my guest really needs an introduction, but Professor Norman Finkelstein is a political scientist and author who in 2020 was named the fifth most influential political scientist in the world. His primary fields of research are the politics of the Holocaust and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's the author of many books, such as The Holocaust Industry, I'll Burn That Bridge When I Get to It, and Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. Professor Finkelstein, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you'll agree with me, but a lot of the media coverage about the horrific events in Gaza is packed with terms and concepts that I believe most people, myself included, to be honest, are not really that well informed about. One such term is Zionism, which apparently means totally different things to different people, especially online, where folks keep throwing the word around quite arbitrarily. I believe you wrote your doctoral dissertation on Zionism, so I thought we could maybe start here. So, Professor Finkelstein, what is Zionism?
Well, I have to preface my remarks by saying it doesn't much make any difference anymore what it was, because its original meaning has been completely lost, in my opinion. And not so much the meaning, but the reasoning behind the meaning. How do they work through this argument? Actually, my doctoral dissertation was entitled From the Jewish Question to the Jewish State, an Essay in the Theory of Zionism. So the reason I began with the Jewish question is, in order to understand what Zionism is, you have to understand what political question it was trying to answer. And the political question it was trying to answer was anti-Semitism. From whence arises anti-Semitism? And is a Jewish state the logical answer, response to anti-Semitism? At the time, in that era, the 19th century, there were all sorts of approaches, if you might call it that, the Jews embraced. There were those who believed in the Enlightenment idea of achieving citizenship within your state, full citizenship, and that would resolve the Jewish question. That notion goes back to the French Revolution and the idea that you can create a state, a nation, on the basis of citizenship. So there were those who fought for equal rights within what you might call a bourgeois democratic state. And that idea at the end of the 19th century seemed not to be working because of outbreaks of anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe, but also in Western Europe, in places like France, with the Dreyfus Affair, the French Jewish officer, Captain Dreyfus, who was very much an assimilated French Jew, who was accused of having been a spy for the Germans.
The famous Jacques affair.
Yes, the one that culminated with Emile Zola's Jacques. Now, there were those who believed that anti-Semitism was inherent in capitalism, the search for scapegoats and things like that of the capitalist system, and that the only answer would have to be a revolutionary transformation of society. And there were a lot of Jews who were wedded to that idea. Most of the Bolshevik leadership, with the partial exception of Lenin. Lenin, it's now said, was one quarter Jewish, but with the partial exception of Lenin and the full exception of Stalin, the entire Bolshevik leadership was Jewish. Trotsky, Kamenev, Zinoviev, Bukharin, they were all Jews. And obviously Jews played a salient role in the leading socialist organization of that era, namely the German Social Democratic Party, where many of its luminaries were Jewish, one among many, being Rosa Luxemburg. So there were those who believed the only way to answer the Jewish question is that you have to abolish capitalism and create a socialist society. Then there were those who believed that we need socialism, but we also need some form of Jewish autonomy, a cultural autonomy within a socialist state. And the most famous of those were, of course, the Bundists. And then there were the Zionists, which were a pretty trivial percentage of the Jewish movement, I think. I can't remember now, but it was a tiny, tiny portion of the Jewish community that embraced the idea of Zionism. The basic idea of Zionism was that every nation, every normal nation, had a state. The French people had the French state. The British people had the British state. Every normal nation had a state. And that Jews were an anomaly because they were a nation without a state. And it was the fact that the Jews didn't have a state that they could call their own. That was allegedly the cause of anti-Semitism. Because the belief was that any nation state can tolerate a minority, but it has a limit before it can no longer tolerate it. The leading Zionist, after Herzl passed from the scene, Theodor Herzl, the leading Zionist was Chaim Weizmann. And Chaim Weizmann was by profession, he was a chemist. And he compared the situation of minorities with a mixture. A mixture meaning you can pour in an alien substance, and most of the time it dissolves in the test tube. But if you put too much of the alien substance into the test tube, it won't dissolve. And he said that was the problem with Jews. They were too large a minority within other nation states, and being too large a minority, they couldn't dissolve, they couldn't assimilate into the nation states around them. And if they couldn't assimilate, they would be conceived as an alien entity. So in order to resolve the Jewish question, you had to create a Jewish state. It didn't have to be 100% Jewish. The Zionists believed that a nation state could tolerate maybe a 10 to 15% minority or 10 to 20% minority. So they didn't want a Simon pure Jewish state, but they wanted a state which was overwhelmingly Jewish, and that they had to preserve that demographic balance, which is kind of what made the expulsion of the Arab population in 1947 inevitable, because they had to rectify the demographic balance in order to create a Jewish state which was overwhelmingly Jewish in its demographic balance. So the basic idea of Zionism was that there was a limit to which non-Jewish societies could assimilate Jews. Jews were too large a minority, and they liked back then to use biological metaphors. Obviously, Weizmann used a chemical metaphor. Others used biological metaphors. And they said the natural reaction of a human body, to a foreign substance is to repel it, to reject it, to push it out. And in the same way, they said the natural substance of a body politic is to repel, to reject, to push out an alien substance. And Jews were, in their view, they were an alien nation. And so people like Jabotinsky, the right-wing Zionist, but certainly not unrepresentative of Zionist thinking, he said that anti-Semitism was normal. It was a normal reaction of a body politic to an alien presence in its midst. And therefore, Jews have to normalize their condition by becoming what was normal, namely a nation state where Jews were overwhelmingly the majority.
Following kind of this line, I was quite surprised then when, during a recent discussion, I heard you say the following: I don't believe Zionism is the operative ideology in Israel today. You went on to make an interesting analogy with the Soviet Union between its early days, when kind of ideology was driving the revolution, I believe, and the later period when the state became, I don't know, a self-sustaining machine and realpolitik sort of took over. So if it's not ideology that's driving Israeli society in 2024, what would you say is then?
That's a fair question. And it's possible I overspoke in that particular point. First of all, I think the overwhelming concerns of the Israeli state, they're geopolitical. Israel wants to dominate the region. It looks with trepidation at any possible or any regional challenge to its hegemony, and it's determined to maintain its what it calls its deterrence capability, that is, its ability to terrorize the other powers in the region into submission. I don't believe that has anything very much to do with Zionism inherently. That is a geopolitical choice that Israel has made. There is the belief by Israelis, which there's an element of truth to it, I suppose. There is the belief among Israelis that the Arab world will never accept a Jewish state, and that they will always be calculating how to enhance their power for, so to speak, the final showdown. Now, that too, in my opinion, has very little to do with Zionism. That's a view of the world, that we will never be accepted because we are actually an artificial entity. We are. They don't believe in themselves as members of the Arab world or the Middle East. They don't believe in themselves as the Middle East. They can see themselves completely as Westerners. They want to be part of the EU. They want to be part of the EU trading bloc. Culturally, they know more about, say, the Upper East Side in New York than I even do. That's a fact. No, that's just a fact. They're completely culturally assimilated to the West. So they recognize they're an alien entity, and they make no effort to bridge that alienness because they have complete contempt for Arabs and for Muslims. They consider them to be, you know, the missing link. These are animals, they're brutish. That's why the language that came out after October 7th came so easily to the lips of the Israelis, because that's what they've always believed, that these Arabs are backward, stupid, and all the rest. So, to some extent, in my opinion, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you believe that you'll never be accepted and you carry on like you'll never be accepted, then you won't ever be accepted. It's not possible. So that too doesn't seem to me to have much to do with Zionism. It does have quite a lot to do with something which is an element in Zionism, which I don't dispute at all. There is, as Zionism evolved, it was an extremely Jewish chauvinist ideology. It was Jews are better. Now, that's common to Jewish culture in general. The notion, you might call it the distorted notion of Jewish chosenness. Now, I understand if you go into the technical thing, chosenness did not mean that you were better. But guess what? That's how most Jews interpreted it, that Jews are better. And there was the fact, it wasn't just an ideological belief. It was an ideological belief that was overdetermined, to use a famous expression by this French Marxist, Althusser. It was an ideological belief that was overdetermined by the phenomenal Jewish success in the secular world in the 20th century. The fact that as Jews like to kvel, kvel is the Yiddish for brag, Jews like to kvel, that they represent 0.00001% of the world's population, but they represent 20% of the Nobel laureates. And their success in business, their success in the arts, their success in every secular dilemma has been dazzling. There's no question about that. And so that, it's kind of inevitable. It goes to your head and it produces this superiority, Jewish chosenness, not in the original religious sense, but this notion of Jews are better. And that has, now I would say, as I said a moment ago, that became a part of Zionism, I think. It wasn't intrinsic to it, but it was very easy for it to become part of the Zionist ideology. And this Jewish chosenness, this Jewish supremacy, yeah, that does have a lot to do with what's going on now. The complete contempt for Arabs and for Muslims, also, by the way, for everybody else. You know, they may be able to communicate with Orban in Hungary, but they have complete contempt for these people. They just think they're garbage. I mean, obviously, Arabs are at the bottom. Arabs and black people are at the bottom, but just above are all the other non-Jews, maybe with the partial exception, of Germans. Where Jews have a kind of respect for the German mental capacity.
So Germans of all people.
Yeah, well, you know, the narcissism of small differences. I remember with my parents, they had contempt for Poles, people of Polish descent, but they hated Germans. Now, they hated Germans, but they didn't look down on Germans. You see, it was different. They would never say it. Like my parents would say, stupid Pole, stupid Pole, stupid Pole. Over, no Jew would ever say stupid German. They would not. So the Germans were the exception. Right now, obviously, the exception is becoming the Chinese. Nobody would say a stupid Chinese. In any event, to get back to your original question, I think the major concerns of Israeli leadership is geopolitical, but I also believe that there is a large component of Jewish supremacy.
Could you pinpoint the moment in Israel's history when this change, this tipping point, this tipping over happened from this ideological state to, like you were saying, desire to dominate in a geopolitical sense?
Well, the desire to dominate was always there. You know, David Ben-Gurion was absolutely convinced, the first prime minister of Israel, he was absolutely convinced the Arab world would never accept Israel. I mean, he was smart enough to realize it was an alien. It was, in many ways, an alien implant. There was no Zionist who wanted to become Arab. That was not going to happen. And Ben-Gurion was low-level Jewish supremacist. So he had complete contempt for the Arabs and never believed that they would also, in addition, they would accept a Jewish state. But he was a Zionist in the sense that he believed in Zionist ideology. He believed we needed to normalize the condition of Jews by creating a normal Jewish state, and that Jews had no future in what was called the diaspora. That diaspora for Jews offered no promise or prospect for the Jewish people. Obviously, for individual Jews here and there, yes, but for Jews as a people, no. And he was actually very disappointed. He expected there would be all the Jews in the world, aside from those who were exterminated, they would flock to the Jewish state. And he was surprised when, for example, the American Jews decided to stay put. There's been very, very little immigration of Jews from the United States to Israel.
Let's go to the other side. Last month, there was a much publicized debate on anti-Zionism in Canada between Douglas Murray and Mehdi Hassan, and the side that claimed that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism won the debate. I feel a bit silly asking this, but in light of this event, I also feel like I kind of have to. Why is anti-Zionism not anti-Semitism?
No, it can be. Listen, philo-Zionism can be anti-Semitism. There, right now, the European right, what you might call the neo-fascists, those who harken back in attitude and mentality and program to the fascist movements of the 1930s, they both revere Israel. And I also think they probably hate Jews, because for them, Israel is not a Jewish state. For them, Israel is a white supremacist state. They see it as a state which loathes the non-Jewish, which loathes the non-Jewish minorities, Arabs, Muslims, which, of course, that's a common sentiment in the European right, with the whole issue of immigration, and they don't want black people from Africa, and they definitely don't want Muslims. You know, those are the two people. And Israel, in that sense, is a model, a paradigm. It's a white supremacist state where the white supremacists happen to be Jewish, but the Jewish part is very marginal. It's the fascist mentality, the Muslims. They hate the Muslims, like Israel. They hate Arabs, like Israel. They hate colored people, like Israel. Israel hates black people. So you could be a philo-Zionist and an anti-Semite. I don't think they like Jews. I don't think the far right, be it in Hungary or in France, they like the Jews. But they like Zionism. As they see Zionism, Zionism is a fascist model, a paradigm for them, at least its current incarnation. And in the same way, you could be, it's perfectly plausible that you're an anti-Zionist and an anti-Semite. I'm sure there's, on a Venn diagram, there are areas of overlap. But there's nothing intrinsic about being anti-Zionist. First of all, as I said, the Zionism plays such a little role now. Who even reads these people? Who reads Herzl? The Zionist thinkers are so mediocre. There's nothing there. I remember once when I was writing my doctoral dissertation, I once said to Professor Chomsky, who was kind of my supervisor, since my own technical supervisors basically were missing in action. And I once asked Professor Chomsky, I said, "Professor Chomsky, do you believe that Zionism has intellectual depth and intellectual content?" And he replied to me, "Norman, let me begin from the beginning. In my opinion, none of the social studies have intellectual depth."
Great, I studied social studies. But there's something to it, to be fair.
He just validated the fact that my whole life was pointless.
I feel you.
Yeah, but like you said, there's no element of fairness to the statement. You have to accept it. In any event, the Zionist thinkers were very thin. There was one who Chomsky liked. I think he had him in mind, Ahad Ha'am, who was smart, no question about it. But the others were. There was really nothing there. So nobody reads them. What's called anti-Zionism is anti-Israel, being anti-Israel. And then the question is whether being, so we could drop Zionism altogether. The question is whether being anti-Israel is intrinsically anti-Semitic. And my answer is there's areas of overlap, but there's no, there's obviously no intrinsic connection between the two. There can be in the real world. There are a lot of excellent reasons to hate Israel. Actually, the last few days, I wouldn't want to tell you the thoughts passing through my head, but I'll tell you, they're not very nice. You know, and I have to really control myself because it's a lunatic state. And it's a lunatic state, and it's bringing us closer. When I say us, I mean the whole world, closer and closer to the precipice. And I don't know where it's going to end. So there are many reasons to hate Israel, which have nothing to do with Jews. They're completely out of control. I think I got an email from my close friend, Sana Qasim, and she's my webmaster, a really brilliant woman. And she said, and she's Palestinian, and she said, the United Nations can't stop them. The International Court of Justice can't stop them. The Houthis and Hezbollah can't stop them. Nothing can stop them. They're just on a lunatic rampage now. Complete lunatics. So there are excellent reasons to be anti-Israel. They have nothing to do with Jews. Though, of course, there's always going to be a spillover, because Israel describes itself as the nation state of the Jewish people. So from hating Israel to hating Jews is not a very big leap when you describe yourself as a nation state of the Jewish people. It's a fleece hop from one to the other. So there's going to be spillover. But in this spillover, we should at least, as a theoretical matter, as a practical matter, it hardly makes a difference, I agree. As a theoretical matter, we should be clear about why that happened. Why the hatred of the Jews? Because this nation state, which calls itself the nation state of the Jewish people, is completely lunatic. It's no different, I mean, as a matter of principle. People didn't hate Nazis during World War II. They hated Germans. They hated Germans. Well, the spillover was pretty easy because the Nazis were the head of a German government. But they didn't denounce Nazis. They denounced Germans, Krauts, as they were called, or Teutonics. So, and it was the same thing if you ever read the literature on the Japanese. We didn't denounce the emperor or the Japanese state. It was the Japanese people. The Nips, as they were called. So that kind of spillover is inevitable, I believe. And then it's very difficult to sort out anti-Israelism from anti-Semitism.
I just watched one of your interviews that came out last week, and you said something that one won't hear on mainstream media, at least not very often. You said that Netanyahu is just a reflection and a representation of Israeli society.
Yeah.
Now, the take that we usually get is, oh, we just need to get rid of Netanyahu and his extremist government, and Israel will become normal again. Could you elaborate a bit more on why that's not the case at all?
It's completely ridiculous. You know, it's like saying the Russian war in Ukraine is Putin's war. Whether you like it or not, it's the whole entire Russian elite who regards a NATO state on its border as posing a threat to the security of Russia. It's not Putin's war. Can you show me somebody in the Russian leadership who opposes, who supports a NATO presence in Ukraine? Is there anybody? And the same thing, is there anybody? You know, Israel is a parliamentary democracy. And tiny parties can have a big impact in tilting the coalition one way or the other. So if you disagreed with Netanyahu, fundamentally disagreed with his policies of trying to make Gaza uninhabitable and also to restore Israel's deterrence capability against Hezbollah and Iran. If you really disagreed with those policies, you could form a party, get 3 seats in the Knesset, and have an impact. Do you see anybody forming a party on that platform? Yeah, there are differences over which you should prioritize now, making Gaza uninhabitable or bringing back the hostages. And after you bring back the hostages, then you continue on the path of making Gaza uninhabitable. There are differences of, you know, they call it tactical differences. But there is no fundamental disagreement with Netanyahu, not only in the Israeli elite, but we have to be clear, in the whole of Israeli society. Israeli society is completely lunatic. It is. It's the entire society is. If you look at the polls, only 4% of Israeli Jewish society believes Israel is using too much force in Gaza. 4%. Oof. And 40% think it's using too little force. That's a completely lunatic society. To try to impose or burden Prime Minister Netanyahu with all the sins of Israel is completely ridiculous. Netanyahu is Israel. He's an obnoxious Jewish supremacist. That's Israel. Obnoxious, I left out an important element. An obnoxious, narcissistic Jewish supremacist. Those are the three characteristics. That is Israel. Obnoxious beyond belief. Narcissistic beyond calculation. And Jewish supremacist. That's Israel. When they see Netanyahu, they see themselves. That's why they vote for him.
On that note, Abby Martin, the American journalist, did a series of street interviews about 6 years ago, so well before October the 7th, where she was just walking around Jerusalem, kind of asking random Israelis what they thought about the Palestinians. Anybody can watch the videos on YouTube. And I have to say, it's pretty terrifying to hear what people were willing to say publicly and on camera. Their answers kind of ranged from, we've got to kick them out of Palestine immediately, to some people simply suggesting that Israel needs to carpet bomb the Palestinian territories. People didn't seem to find what they were saying problematic in the slightest. Again, we're not talking about post-October 7th here. It's just quite startling.
If you go back and read the literature by even very respected figures in American culture during the conquest of the West, they talked about the Indians as being savages. They all did, but it was just the lingua franca of American society. Everybody referred to them as savages, they have to be wiped out, and so on and so forth. There's a decent book titled American Holocaust. And there's a very long chapter, a very dispiriting chapter, on the attitudes of Americans towards the Native Euro-Americans towards the Native Americans. If you read stuff like the Theodore Roosevelt, the American president, if you saw the way he talked about Native Americans, but it wasn't just Roosevelt, it was even people like Frank Baum, the author of The Wizard of Oz. It was everyone. To be perfectly candid about it, when I was growing up, I was an aficionado of cowboy and Indian movies. And I was always rooting for the cowboys to kill, to burn, not just to kill, to incinerate the savages. And that was when it was already over and the native population was already wiped out. But the residue, that feeling, still carried over in our culture. Actually, the first film to humanize Native Americans, the very first film, was, I think, 1975, something around there. It was called Little Big Men, and it starred Dustin Hoffman. It was the first film that presented the Native Americans as being actually human beings. So I don't find that totally shocking among the Israelis. That they consider they want to wipe out. I wanted to wipe out the Native Americans after they were already wiped out. What shocks me is the denial. Like yesterday, the New York Times had an article, or either yesterday or 2 days ago. You know, the rioting at the prison where they're sodomizing prisoners. They called it a battle for Israel's soul. Come on, guys. That's like a battle for Germany's soul in an SS barracks. It's so completely divorced. They're still trying to project the images of an Israeli soul. Guys, that died a long time ago. When Israelis post videos of their euphoria and elation as they murder and torture Arabs on the social media, knowing full well they're not going to be ostracized, but quite the contrary, they're going to be celebrated, there's very little soul left there. So that's enough already. As the Spanish would say, bastante, enough already, bastante, bastante, enough with the soul. It's all for the New York Times, the Upper East Side Jewish billionaire supremacists, because that's the New York Times' basic, it's its reader base, the Upper East Side. So they want to still convince, you know, they know the Jews in the Upper East Side, the billionaire Jewish supremacists. They love to hear about the Jewish soul, the Israeli soul.
I'm originally from Slovenia, so the Balkans, but I used to live in Berlin for nearly a decade. I didn't speak any German, and I had extremely limited options when I arrived to the German capital. I started guiding people to bars at night. I was what's known as a pub crawl guide, not a very dignified profession. Most of my clients were Australians and Americans and English, but there was a fair share of Israelis too. It was always a group of young guys who had just come from serving in the IDF.
And they had to have been the most obnoxious.
For some reason, they quite liked me. I don't know, perhaps because they knew I wasn't German, maybe. And as soon as they got a bit more relaxed around me, they would almost always say that they could feel that the Germans still wanted to kill them all. It was quite startling, and it always shook me. In the Balkans, we grew up with plenty of horror stories that our grandparents told us. And yet, in all my time in Berlin, I never felt that any German wanted to harm me just because I'm a Slav or something.
The inverted narcissism.
Hear me out, Professor.
They have to want to kill us. They're always the center of everything. No, guys. Actually, the Germans don't give a flying fig about you.
Well, I do have to say that they seemed like they really believe in what they were saying. They just looked utterly paranoid, which got me thinking, that maybe being forced into the army in your formative years and then pumped with paralyzing fear and told that anyone who's not Jewish wants to murder you is probably not ideal for your psyche, right? So I wonder what your thoughts about the role of military indoctrination of young people in Israel are.
Oh, there is a very real problem. First of all, that's part of the Jewish psyche. You have to remember. Did you ever see Woody Allen's Annie Hall?
Yeah, of course. It's a classic.
It's absolutely hilarious. When they're walking down Central Park and somebody says to him, "So what do you think?" He said, "What do you mean, what you..." I think everything anyone says, he hears Jew. That's it. He always hears the Jew. And the Goyim are always trying to oppress him. You know? So that's part of Jewish psyche. What is true in what you're saying is, remember, every Israeli is a war criminal, in the literal sense. Every Israeli is a war criminal or 6 degrees removed from a war criminal. Because every Israel has a citizen army. It's representative of the whole of Israeli society, aside, you know, from the Orthodox. It's a wholly representative cross-section of Israeli society. They all serve in the army. And at some time, they're committing a war crime. They're breaking into homes in the West Bank. They're ransacking homes, terrorizing children, humiliating Palestinians at the checkpoints. Or periodically, they're bombing Gaza in one of their periodic murder sprees. Every Israeli is involved in the subjugation of a population which is literally half its size. There are about 15 million people living between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, And half of them are not Arab. And in order to subjugate them, you need a very large human apparatus to perpetuate and perpetuate that subjugation of the Arab population in what B'Tselem, the Israeli Human Rights Organization for the Occupied Territories, would have called. It said, from the river to the sea, there's a Jewish supremacist state. I think that's an accurate description. Different degrees of Jewish supremacy. In the case of the Israel proper, you could say the Arabs are second or third class citizens. In the case of the West Bank, you could say the Arabs are subjected to an apartheid regime. And the case of Gaza, they're subjected to an genocidal assault. So it's different degrees of Jewish supremacy, but it's a Jewish supremacist state. In order to maintain that Jewish supremacist state, they don't have an isolated apparatus. Yes, they have a special forces, but the special forces is integrated into a citizen army, every member of which is a war criminal, or you can be 6 degrees separated. It could be your brother, it could be your sister, it could be your mother, it could be your father, it could be your son, it could be your daughter. So in that sense, yes, the army experience has morally tainted them, because they feel a sense of, there but for the grace of God go I, meaning I would be committing that war crime, because they're all doing it. How do you Gaza's no more. Gaza's gone. There's no Gaza anymore. How do you decimate a parcel of land, half of whom are children? How do you do it except by committing massive, off-the-charts war crimes? And who's doing it? It's not an isolated apparatus. It's the whole of Israeli society.
Let's turn to the events in Gaza. Before I get a call from Piers Morgan asking me if I condemn the attacks on October the 7th. Mm-hmm. I have to stress that there is no doubt in my mind that the events of that day were obviously harrowing. And what made Hamas's attacks even more tragic was the fact that apparently a lot of civilians that got killed were actually sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. Nevertheless,
I find that very implausible. I think we have to speak to facts as they are. It doesn't mean you deserve the fate that you suffered. But a lot of them sympathetic to Palestinians? No, sorry. You're living next door to a concentration camp. You know it is. You know everything. You know it's a sealed off parcel of land. You know a million children, a little more than a million children are trapped in there. You know all that. What did you do? I mean, what did you do? I'm not going to say I'm better, but I'm going to just, you know, I live in a city with all these homeless people. And what do I do? I do something, I'll say, but not very much. But let's not do this, oh, they're sympathetic to the Palestinians. The number of people sympathetic to the Palestinians you can fit in my apartment, and I can assure you that's not a very big apartment. You have to be honest about those things. 96% of Israelis believe Israel is using sufficient force or should be using more force in Gaza. Israeli Jews believe Israel is using sufficient force or should be using more force in Gaza. So I hear things like a lot of them were set up. Please stop.
Yeah, those statistics that you quoted are horrifying. I did want to say that nevertheless, all major media outlets in the West are still pretending that the attack, as brutal as it was, happened in a vacuum and without any context whatsoever. It's a starting point, usually, of any debate. I suppose it just makes for more convenient framing. Now, I believe you said that you attribute the motivations for the attack to utter desperation and a feeling of abandonment on their side. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Well, already in 2004, head of Israel's National Security Council, Gior Eiland, in March 2004, he described Gaza as, quote, a huge concentration camp. It was people sealed off, hermetically sealed off from the outside world. No one could go in, nobody can go out. nothing can go in, nothing can go out without Israel's permission. And Israel imposed a brutal, illegal siege on Gaza. And a good part of it, I would say, obviously I don't have any proofs, but you would guess, based on circumstantial evidence, which I can't go through now, you would guess that probably 3/4 of the young men who burst the gates of Gaza on October 7th, they were born into Gaza. They were born into a concentration camp. I don't want to go through the circumstantial evidence because it wouldn't interest people. But my guess is most of them were unmarried, because if they were married, they wouldn't have been selected for the mission because it was a suicide mission. And they knew they wouldn't come back. So they wouldn't, if they're married, they have children, because children rapidly appear on the scene when you're married in Gaza. So they would have children and they would have a wife to support. And so they probably would not have volunteered for that mission when there were others who were younger, who weren't yet married and didn't yet have children. Which means if they were younger, they were probably, you would guess, around 20 years of age. And as I said, Gior Island was describing Gaza in 2004, 20 years ago, as a huge concentration camp. So most of the young men, in my opinion, based on circumstantial evidence, were probably born into the concentration camp. And the only expectation was to languish and die there. There was no future. There was not even a present or a past. There was nothing. All they were left to do was, Gaza is about the length of a marathon, 26 miles. The width, 5 miles, is what I jog every day at the beach. That's the whole of Gaza. So all they had to do, because 60% of them were unemployed, young people were unemployed by October 7th. 60% were unemployed. 80% are living on government subsidies from UN agencies. So all they had to do was get up in the morning and pace the perimeter of Gaza. That's all they had left to do. There was nothing. They were never going to get married. Can't get married if you can't. If you don't have a job in Gaza, that's not possible. So they had no past. They had no present. They had no future. And beyond that, a large number of them, they were bore witness to Israel's high-tech killing sprees, that are called operations in Israel, be it Operation Cast Lead in 2008-09, Operation Pillar of Defense 2010, Operation Protective Edge 2014, where Israel comes in to what are called mowing the lawn. Mowing the lawn was, you take out your giant mower, their rockets, their artillery, their bombs, and they take the mower with its blades and they crack the skulls of people, most of whom are, or I should say half of whom are children. So they saw their relatives perish, be murdered by this killing machine. And they wanted, like any normal person, whether for good or for bad, it's normal. They wanted to exact revenge. And they did on October 7th. Am I better? Forget it.
The images we keep getting from Gaza are unlike anything I've ever seen in my life. And I've seen some pretty bad things. I've had to mute most social media accounts that are reporting from there because I literally could not sleep anymore. And yet the horror goes on. 80% of all buildings, I believe, in Gaza have been razed to the ground, all major universities and hospitals blown to bits. 2 weeks ago, the British medical journal The Lancet reported that the number of Palestinian casualties might actually be almost 200,000. I mean, if that's true, that's roughly 10% of the entire population in Gaza, I believe.
I understand that wasn't a good study. I just have to be honest about that.
Uh-huh.
But my guess is that those numbers are completely plausible. If you consider the fact that Gaza is the most densely populated place on Earth, or one of the most densely populated places on Earth, and Israel has now dropped more ordnance on Gaza than was dropped in Hamburg, Dresden, and London combined during World War II. You have to assume that a huge portion of the population is gone.
I wanted to ask, you know, at the same time, even the IDF says that Hamas is nowhere near any kind of defeat, which was reportedly their goal at the beginning. When do you think this horrific campaign will stop?
First of all, I trust the IDF about as much as I trust Goebbels during World War II. When is it going to end? I think one aspect of it is pretty much over, namely turning Gaza into an unlivable, uninhabitable, howling wilderness. I think that's pretty much over. First of all, it's had very little to do with Hamas so far. If you follow, even on a superficial level, if you follow the events, there are no battles in Gaza. Has anybody heard of a battle? You hear about a soldier being killed here, a soldier being killed there, probably by a random shot by one Hamas fighter, but there are no battles. So defeating Hamas to me is a meaningless concept. A large number have been killed, but that's because they've been killed like civilians have been killed in the indiscriminate bombing of Gaza. That's why Hamas fighters were killed. But because of actual warfare battles, it's not true. So I don't think the issue is Israel, for Israel to claim a military victory, and it'll claim it if they can kill Sinwar. If they can kill the head of the Yahya Sinwar, they can kill the head of Hamas, then they were a military wing of Hamas, and they can claim a military victory. But I don't believe it'll be over then, because Israel will not tolerate Hezbollah. It won't tolerate what Hezbollah did, has done since October 7th. And so there's a new battle looming, and then there's another battle looming with Iran, or simultaneously. So we may still be closer to the beginning than to the end. And it may go all over. Biden is a lunatic himself, a senile lunatic, a lunatic. And if Israel gets attacked, he may roll out the nuclear weapons. It's very grim. The only thing you could do is bury your head in the ground and just continue working on what you're working on and hope it'll have some meaning, because it may not, because it's out of our control. It's what my friend Sanda said, nothing can stop them. They're a lunatic state on a rampage, complete lunatic state, and they're on a rampage.
Last December, South Africa launched an attempt at the International Court of Justice to prove that Israel was committing genocide in Gaza. You've read the case. Why do you think it's convincing?
Not a complicated case, in my point. It is complicated how you define genocide. And that's a legal, it has a legal and has a dictionary aspect to it. The legal aspect is built on what's called precedent. And how has the international community, be it the ICJ or the ICC, the International Court of Justice, or the International Criminal Court, how in its jurisprudence, its precedence, how it's defined genocide. And that's a technical matter. We have an Oxford English Dictionary and its spin-offs. As a general matter, the attempt to destroy a people in whole or in part. And I think it's to my view, incontestable that since October 7th, Israel has embarked on a campaign to destroy the Palestinian component of, the Gaza component of the Palestinian people. That to me is an incontestable fact. I think the evidence South Africa adduced in its application on December 29, 2022 is overwhelming and irrefutable. I have read it not once, not twice. I've read it many times because I'm writing about it right now. There's, in my opinion, there's no way reading this accumulation of data and eyewitness testimony without concluding that Israel has embarked on a campaign of destruction of the people of Gaza.
I was born in Yugoslavia, a country that ended violently with the last genocide in Europe, where 8,000 boys and men got massacred in Srebrenica. I know it's not only the number of victims that counts in the eyes of the ICJ, but it's also about intent. But still, we're talking about at least 40,000 dead Palestinians, most of whom, like you said, are women and children, right?
The numbers, like you say, are an index of the horror. And they certainly play a significant role in evaluating what's happened. But it's also the details. The targeting of UN workers, targeting of journalists, targeting of humanitarian aid organizations, targeting of children, shooting them with one bullet to the head, children, the denial of humanitarian, the systematic denial of humanitarian aid, the use of food as a weapon of war, or denial of food as a weapon of war. When you look at the horrifying details, I don't see how you can, I always reserve in my mind an element of doubt. Is this genocide? Is this genocide? But then you start going through the data, and all the data comes from the world's most eminent and respected human rights organizations. If you look at the sources for all of the information, where is it coming from? It's coming from the UN Commissioner and High Commissioner on Human Rights. You're getting it from Save the Children, UNICEF, UNESCO, Doctors Without Borders, Oxfam, UNCTAD, United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, World Bank, are they all lying? Are they all making it up? Is there this vast conspiracy to mount this monumental hoax that this is not that it's really not happening? It's all being faked. But if what all these organizations are reporting in concert is true, then this is the destruction of a people. The title of Raoul Hilberg, the great historian and Nazi Holocaust, the title of his monumental work was called The Destruction of the European Jews. And this is the destruction of the people of Gaza.
Kamala Harris just became the official nominee of the Democratic Party. If she ends up winning the presidential elections in November, do you think there's any chance that the American foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel will shift at all?
There is no chance at all. Zero. Biden was brain dead for the last 4 years. So most of the policy was being made by Jake Sullivan, by Secretary of State Blinken. Yeah, Biden was an element, but he didn't have the mental capacity really to make lucid decisions. Kamala Harris is a moron. She's stupid. She has no competence for the job. It's a very funny thing that happened because Biden only selected her. He said, the reason I selected her is she's a black woman. They wanted to nail down the black woman vote. So they selected Kamala Harris. He was doing that all the time, Biden. In the case of Ketanji Brown Jackson, who he nominated for the Supreme Court, she's very smart. So that wasn't what you would call an affirmative action choice. She's smart. She's a very smart black woman. Then he chose a black woman lesbian for his press secretary. She seems to be pretty stupid. And that was a choice. You want to nail down the black woman vote. So that's the only reason Kamala Harris was selected. She has no competence. She has nothing. There's nothing there. She's a complete moron. And then what happened was, it was kind of funny. So the Democrats want to get rid of Biden because he's a corpse, and he's an embarrassing corpse now because the totalitarian PR machine of the Democratic Party couldn't conceal it any longer. It was just out there, impossible to hide. They thought they could hide it and then get the election, and he'll just sit in his in the office eating jelly beans like Ronald Reagan, and his advisors would do everything. So that's what they hoped for, but then it imploded, you know, after the debate with Trump. Disaster, disaster, disaster. So they all sang Biden, he has to leave. Now, Biden was so demented that he didn't know he was demented. I mean, that's what happens when you get demented. You don't know you're demented. So they had to force the guy out, right? So Biden's, he is not, even in his demented state, there are moments of lucidity, and he came up with a very good idea. He says, Schumer, Pelosi, Obama, they want me out, okay? All right, I'm going to leave, but you know what he said? I'm going to stick it to them. And you know how he stuck it to them? He said, I'm going to support Kamala Harris. So now he's thinking, you don't want me? You don't want me? You don't want me? Now you're stuck with her. And they didn't know what to do. Now they were stuck with Kamala Harris because he endorsed her. So what are they going to do? If you remember, the three people who most were working hardest behind the scenes to get rid of Biden were Schumer, Pelosi, and Obama. They were also the last three to endorse Kamala Harris. They were the last three. Obama was the very end, but even before that, it was hard to get Pelosi until they realized they're stuck. Because if they didn't endorse her, it would be, oh, you see how they treat black women? She was, should have been the person, and they didn't support her. So, and you know, she's intersectionally oppressed because she's a black, you know, all that crap, all that woke crap. So they were stuck now with Kamala Harris, and she's a complete incompetent. So she will just be another figurehead. And you can be sure she's going to nominate Blinken for Secretary of State and Jake Sullivan for National Security, because she doesn't know what she's doing. I'm not going to change anything.
Who do you think was their candidate of Pelosi, Schumer, and Obama?
I think probably they wanted an open convention and see who would. Well, open convention, let's be clear. The Democratic Party is a totalitarian party. And so there is no open anything. Everything is decided behind closed doors. Remember, Kamala Harris came in fourth in her own state in the 2020 primary. I mean, to come in fourth in your own state in the primary, you have to be just so terrible. I probably could have done better if I campaigned for 24 hours in California than Kamala Harris. Everything has to be decided behind closed doors. There can't be any popular input. That's not the way the Democratic Party works. Everything has to be decided behind closed doors. So when I say an open convention, they would take their five, you know, major picks and see who does the best. But it would only be five, because we have to control everything. These are totalitarians. We have to control everything.
Last question, Professor. I realize this is probably not your favorite topic, but a couple of months ago, you famously debated the streamer Destiny on Lex Fridman's podcast, and saying that you weren't particularly impressed with his performance is a bit of an understatement. Among other things, you said to him, "You're such a fantastic moron, it's terrifying." What do you think of the phenomena of online celebrities and famous streamers being propped up as experts in the public sphere these days?
I think that's always been a phenomenon. That thing called Destiny, I wouldn't say he's prominent in the public eye. He has a cult following, this weird cult following of white male losers, ages probably 17 to 25, who are confined to their parents' basements, and they shuttle between video games and Pornhub. And in between shuttling back and forth, they stop to watch Destiny, who's their guru. Really weird, creepy types. They're what you might call Destiny's dingleberries. And every once in a while, he releases them to go on some website and say how he defeated me in debate and how brilliant he is. And they're a little cult. They probably really believe it. They have to believe it because it's their last hope. They have to believe that destiny, who's one of their own, is a genius. Otherwise, if he's just, the Queen Dingleberry, it's not very impressive. But I've always been that type. Actually, if you remember, just before these online streamers came along, most of the news was being delivered by comedians, or purported to be comedians. Who would people watch for the news? They watch Jon Stewart. What does Jon Stewart know about anything? Or they watch Bill Maher. What is Bill Maher? He has horn-rimmed glasses and he thinks he's a genius. No, you're a moron wearing horn-rimmed glasses. So that's sort of people with profound incompetence pretending to render judgment. But even, what distinguished that thing called destiny from the others is, in my opinion, the complete lack of self-awareness. So, for example, I publicly offered to debate Jordan Peterson.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I offered to debate Ben Shapiro. Now, they were at least self-aware enough to know don't debate him, because you're going to make a fool of yourself. They had enough, Peterson was, I think, a Harvard professor in psychology, if my memory is right. Ben Shapiro went to Harvard Law School. So they have some knowledge of what it means to possess knowledge, and therefore don't debate him. I was supposed to debate the former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert, at Oxford. And Oxford, they don't pay for your ticket to come over. So I said, look, guys, I'll pay for my ticket, but please confirm with Olmert that he's going to debate me, because I'm not going to buy a ticket and then I lose the money. And they checked with him a second time. He agreed. And then he backed out. He probably watched some of my YouTube videos and thought, I think I'll take a rain check on this one. That thing called destiny is he's such an imbecile that he doesn't even know how stupid he is. He thinks reading Wikipedia entries, which is what he said he did, reading 5 Wikipedia entries qualifies you to go in a room with 3 other people who've spent their entire lives devoted to studying the subject. So most people would have been prudent enough to say, I'll take a pass. But I was later told that there was more to the story than I have stated so far. And I was told by very, I would call it, an unimpeachable source that thing called destiny was being handsomely compensated by certain organizations. And maybe because he's so stupid and so lacking in self-awareness, maybe he, and the money, the temptations that come with the money, that he was willing to take the chance. And that's it. I don't think that's a new phenomenon. People pontificating about politics who have no knowledge, understanding, never having studied or participated in politics. His is just another level of degradation of the political process, because it's a cult. It's a cult. Destiny's dingleberries. It's a cult.
Professor Finkelstein, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, please consider subscribing to Smart Cookies on YouTube. What else is there? Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And if you really liked what you heard, feel free to become my Patreon. No, my patron on Patreon by going to Patreon and becoming my patron. It's really easy. Just type Smart Cookies Podcast in there. You should be able to find me. Last but not least, I have to thank the absolute legends that are my producers on this show, my existing patrons on Patreon: Aida, Mancian, Miha Medved, Medinho, Gordon, Jurečuk, Lorenzo, Mila, Carmen, Taichi, Goran, and Veronica. Without you guys, this show wouldn't exist. So massive thanks. And yeah, see you in the next episode. Bye.